When we talk to others about prophecy in particular, sometimes about revelation, sometimes we hear some reasonable thoughts and sometimes some that seem very fanciful indeed. So what can we say to someone who has, what shall we say, very different ideas? Do we simply come back with, well, these are my unreasonable ideas? Or if it's possible, can we show evidence to them? Some evidence for the things that we would understand. And so what we like to do is not to convince others so much as to help others to convince themselves. And we'd like to go now to the next slide. When you look at the map of Italy, what do you see? Now, some people will tell you, well, I see a boot kicking a ball. Now, there are a couple of things that might cause us a little reservation on that. It's not a very round-looking ball, is it? And besides which, if there's been an encounter between the ball and the boot, which one seems to have won? Now what do we see, looking at Daniel 2:34? Do we see a stone smiting Nebuchadnezzar's image on the feet, knocking the legs out from under the Roman Empire? Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon the feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them in pieces. Sometimes the Lord doesn't leave much to the imagination. Now that's in the second chapter of Daniel. Suppose we go on to the fifth chapter. Now on the left you'll see what might have been the inscription written in Hebrew writing, with Hebrew alphabet. But if we put those into English samples, symbols, we might have a little better chance through the English alphabet. Now, if you try to look at that on the right side there, and you try to read from left to right, does it make any sense? Or if you try to read it from right to left, does it make any sense? I think we could understand why the wise men of Babylon couldn't make it out. But on the other hand, this is suggested by the Jewish Sansino commentary. And that's that you have the letters there, but you can only make sense of them if you read from top to bottom and from right to left. And then you can see Mina, Mina, Tekel, Upharsin. So we can see how the Lord could have provided that all the wise men of Babylon could not make anything out of it, but Daniel could come in and read the whole thing and give the interpretation thereof. Now, I might just mention, we're accustomed to the idea of writing from left to right. Hebrew is usually written from right to left. Not always, but there is a common reason for it. If you are right-handed and you are writing with an ink that doesn't dry very readily, if you try writing from right to left, you're going to sometimes smear the writing that you've just written. On the other hand, if you are writing this in stone, as Moses did with the tablets of the law the second time, if you try writing from left to right, then as you're hammering this in, the rough parts of the stone that you've just carved out will be really making your hand rough, cutting it up. So there's a practical reason. If you're writing with a pen, it's preferable to write from left to right. But if you're carving it in stone, more practical doing it from right to left. Now, that doesn't mean that there hasn't been evidence that both have been done. I think I've seen one thing from archaeology where they were writing from right to left, and then the second line was written from left to right, and then right to left, and left to right. And when they did so, they turned the letters around to the other direction as well. I was talking with a Japanese lady something like 60 plus years ago, and she said, well, we write from right to left. And I asked her, what do you do if you're going to be quoting an English word? Putting an English word down. Oh, it says in that case, we write from left to right, or we read from top to bottom. We don't care. Any direction is right, is fine with us. So let's go further. When we go to Daniel chapter 7, a question is asked. You've got all four beasts there. How many heads do they have? And well, you think, there is one that has more than one head. That's the third, the leopard beast. It has four heads. And then add the heads together of the other three, and you get seven heads. Well, put them together, how many horns do they have? Well, how many horns does a lion have? None. A bear? None. A leopard? None. The only horns it has are the horns that are on the fourth beast, the indescribable beast, and that's 10 horns initially. Now, it doesn't stay that way. That 11th horn comes up, and then three horns are taken up before it, so we're down to 8. But initially, the indescribable, the four beasts together have 7 heads and 10 horns. Does that help to explain to someone what the dragon of Revelation 12 is about? The beast in Revelation 13? So we have some evidence for understanding. Also we have it in chapter 17. The 7 heads and 10 horns are in each of those three chapters, 12, 13, and 17. Now in chapter 12, the diadems are on the heads. But when we go to chapter 13, now we see the diadems are on the horns. So by that, we understand that the heads pretty much come first, and after that, we have the diadems on the horns that with the downfall of the West Roman Empire, we now have the horns wearing the diadems. And we notice, just in case there's any doubt about it, Revelation chapter 13, verse 2, gives the beasts in reverse order to what they are in Daniel 7. It lists them in the order of leopard, that's number 3, bear, number 2, lion, number 1. So, when we're talking to someone, we can give them evidence for a rational interpretation. Now we'll go a little further. In Daniel chapter 8, you see the coin on the left. That was a Persian coin. And we see it showing a two-horned ram from the side view. The other horn is obviously on the other side. The Persians pictured themselves as a ram. So Daniel could easily interpret it, seeing the ram, that it was talking about Persia. because they used the ram as their symbol. Now, on the other hand, when we go to Greece, we see we commonly call it a Grecian coin there on the right. But technically, it is a Macedonian coin. And they show themselves as a goat. Now, you'll notice on the east side of Greece is the Aegean Sea. Literally, that means the goat sea, because that's the sea that leads to Macedonia, up where Thessalonica are. We heard about that in the last talk. So, they picture themselves as a goat with a horn in an unusual place in the forehead. That's the coin on top. We see the same thing in the coin down in the bottom. Only here we see not only the goat, but also the ram, but with the horn of the goat over the fallen ram. So in their own coins, we can see the evidence for interpreting the ram and the goat in Daniel chapter 8. And now we may go on to the next slide. I thought I knew what a dragon looked like until I saw the Roman imperial ensign of the dragon. It is composed of the body and the head. The body is the body of a serpent. Can we easily trace that back to the Garden of Eden? But it's got the head of a wolf. Why the head of a wolf? Well, Thrace used the wolf as their symbol. Now, you remember the story that they tell about Romulus and Remus founded Rome. They were suckled by a wolf. That was really saying they got their support from Thrace on the west coast of the Black Sea, an area that includes modern Bulgaria. So, this was the Roman imperial ensign. Now, just as a little aside, it didn't become the imperial ensign until sometime in the 3rd century. So the school of higher criticism came up to the conclusion that the writings of John couldn't possibly have been written until the late 3rd century. However, in the 1930s, a number of manuscripts of the New Testament were discovered, including a part of Revelation, the center third of Revelation from the early 3rd century. So, we have the symbol of the dragon used in Revelation 12 already at least half a century before the Romans used it as their imperial ensign. And that's pretty strong evidence of prophecy and prophecy fulfilled. Now, where does Thrace come from? It's a sort of a little bit slurred version of the Tiras that we find already in Genesis 10, verse 2. That from Noah, we have Japheth. And from Japheth, we have a number of sub-tribes. And the last one mentioned is Tiras, or Thrace, which is why when they made a colony on the east side of the Mediterranean, we call it Tira, or Tyre. And the things that are written, and I think it's in Isaiah 14 and or Ezekiel 28, where it's talking about Satan as the king of Tyre. And yet the prophecy seems to be talking about Rome. Why so? Well, it is because Tiras, Thrace, on the west coast of the Black Sea, was the source of the colonies in Rome and Tyre. So ethnically, they are the same people. So when we read the prophecies of Tyre, very often it does make sense that it's talking about spiritual Babylon or Rome. Now I'll go a little further here. This upper coin is a coin of Constantine. You can maybe see on the left side and going upward, it says Constantinus. And on the back side of the coin, you can see how he pictured things. He has erected the cross over the fallen dragon. And underneath, we have the coin of Constantius. Now, Constantius' wife was a Christian, an Arian Christian. So Constantius displays on his coin, picturing himself as over the fallen dragon, which is underneath his feet. Let's note also, on their heads, you see this string of jewels, both the one of Constantine and the one of Constantius down below. That string of jewels is the diadem crown of the Roman Empire. And we'll see more about that in the next slide. These first two, first there's the heruli or heralds, and on the right side are the Ostrogoths. Both of them were Germanic tribes, descended from the Ashkenaz in Genesis chapter 10. The head of the heruli was Odoacer or Odoacer, however you want to pronounce it. And you'll see on that coin on the left that with a little difficulty you can make out that string of jewels. And that string of jewels, again, is the diadem of the empire. So who is he? Well, Odoacer was head of the heralds, and Rome was employing the heralds as the military for the West Roman Empire. And what resulted was that the emperor at that time was a very young Romulus Augustus. His uncle was really running the show, and he was utterly corrupt. So Odoacer at the head of the heruli came, and they overturned the government. They made Romulus Augustus a private citizen out on his own farm. And as for his horribly corrupt uncle, they slaughtered him. They slew him. So Odoacer put an end to the West Roman Empire. That was in AD 476. And he reigned for about 17 years. And then the East Roman Emperor persuaded the head of the Ostrogoths to go from north of Rome and Greece and go down into Italy and put an end to Odoacer and the Heruli rule. And so the Ostrogothic rule was established in Italy. Now, that coin in the middle, that is of Theodotus, and you'll notice this is a very elaborate string of jewels he's got there, double string of jewels. Some of the others of these Ostrogothic coins are not quite so fancy with the string of jewels. Now, what's the significance of the diadem? If they got the permission of the East Roman Emperor to wear the diadem and display it on their coins, then their coins were valid for doing business anywhere in the Roman Empire, east or west. So now we have two of the Germanic tribes displaying the coins on their coins, the diadem. Let's go to two more. Next, we come to the Lombards. They came into Italy later than did the um, those of the heralds and the Ostrogoths. But they did come. And again, you'll see the diadem on the head of these fellows here. Let's see if I can find out what the name of, yes, Cunibert, I think it is the top coin. And those are three different emperors there of the Lombard rule. And we have also the Vandals. They conquered Rome, but they left. They actually went first westward into Spain and then from Spain into North Africa. They took over North Africa and also Corsica and Sardinia, the big islands in the Mediterranean. Now, of these, three of these tribes completely lost their identity in the Kingdom of Italy. And that's the Heruls, the Ostrogoths, and the Lombards. There are some who think that the third horn that was uprooted was the Vandals, but they did continue their existence through North Africa and the islands of the Mediterranean. So we now have at this point four tribes, four Germanic tribes displaying the diadem of the empire. So let's continue and see if how many more there are of these Germanic tribes that display the diadem. Here we have the Visigoths who went into Spain and the Sueves into Portugal on the west coast of the Iberian Peninsula. And you may notice that the diadem is being worn by each of their kings. Okay, can you keep in mind how many we have seen so far? Let's go on to the next. On the left side, we see a coin of the Franks. Of course, they went into France, largely the north and west parts of France. And on the right, we see coins of the Burgundians, who went to the southeast part of France. Okay, how many coins have we seen now? How many tribes? Let's go on to the next ones. The Alemans took over Germany, particularly southwest Germany, including Württemberg, that played a big role in the early part of the German Empire. And on the right, we see the coins of the Anglo-Saxons. They're probably the poorest coins of all those that we have seen. But you can still see the diadem on the right side. So now, how many coins have we seen so far? Have you counted them? When we get to the last one here, the Anglo-Saxons, where do we get the name England? From the Angles, Angleland, or England. So if I have counted them correctly, we have exactly 10 Germanic tribes displaying the diadem of the Roman Empire. And isn't that exactly what we see not in Revelation chapter 12, where the diadems are on the seven heads, but Revelation 13, where now the diadems are on the 10 horns. So could this help somebody that you are talking to understand that there is a real solid basis for our understanding prophecy? Now we go to another coin. This is a papal coin on the left. On the right, we see a coin of Vespasian from before the time Rome became papal Rome. And on the right, what we see is not a diadem crown, but the Stephanos, or laurel wreath of victory. That is the way Vespasian pictured things in the time when he was coming against Jerusalem. And note what we see on the right side. The woman sitting on hills, sitting on, can you count the number of hills? If you count them closely, it's exactly seven hills. Rome claims to be built on seven hills. By the way, just as an aside, when Constantinople was built, it was built on seven hills. So they call themselves New Rome. But in the coin here on the right, the back side of it here, we see underneath the seven hills a wolf. So again, we see the tie-in with Thrace on the west coast of the Black Sea. That originally it was from Thrace that they settled the west coast of Italy, and that's why they call it the Tyrrhenian Sea on the west of Italy, meaning the Rhenes, the waters, Tyrrhenian, the waters of Tyre. The first inhabitants of the Italian peninsula were the Etruscans. So then, when the Romans went back east to take over territory on the west of the Black Sea, that's why it's called Romania. Now, on the left side, we see a papal coin. And it may be quite a surprise there what we see, because on the back side of the coin, we see a woman there holding out a cup, holding out a cup to the nations. And can we remember a scripture there in Jeremiah 51:7? Chapters 50 and 51 list the sins of Babylon. And so among them is that she's got her golden cup of apostasy that she offers the nations. So the Pope now becomes the 11th horn. And I think it is from them we see three of the horns picked up and unplucked. And that would be, as I say, I think that that would be the heralds, the Ostrogoths, and the Lombards. There still is a part of Italy in the northwest corner that is called Lombardy. And those of you particularly from Wisconsin may remember the name Vince Lombardi, and that is where it comes from. So we'll go on to the next. Now, when we're looking at Revelation, there are two different kinds of crown. There's the string of jewels that's on the left coin, and that's the Emperor Valens with his crown. He's in the 4th century. And that's a fancy diadem, all right. And that is the reigning crown. On the right is what the earlier emperors wore. That's that laurel wreath of victory crown. And this is the Emperor Nerva just before 100. So the early ones wore the laurel wreath of victory. The later ones wear the diadem crown, the reigning crown. Now in Revelation, the diadem crown is not so often seen, but we see it in Revelation 12:3 and 13:1. And both of those pertain to the seven heads and the ten horns. On the other hand, it's used one more place concerning our Lord in Revelation 19:12, where it's used then in a very positive sense. The common word that's used translated crown in Revelation is done so in several places, and usually in a good sense, but one case not. I'll just cite these here. Revelation 2:10, 3:21, I think it is. It may be 3:11, I think it is. 4:4, 4:10, 6:2, 12:1, 14:14. But once in chapter 9, verse 7, it's used of Satan's locusts. So it gives us a thought perhaps as to when we can speak of Jesus reigning and not reigning according to which crown is spoken of. We can go a little further now to one of our last slides. So, when we're going to study prophecy, there are certain things that we might give priority to. See, I've lost something here. Here we are. That we must give our priority to interpretations of things to be fulfilled in the lifetime of you and me. Because only then can it be verified or falsified. If I interpret a prophecy as something that's so far in the future that it can never be shown wrong, then of what use is it to us now? But if I do my best to understand the prophecies and discuss them with others, it's best if it's something that we can actually observe whether it does or does not come to pass. And those are the prophecies of greater interest because they may show us what we should be doing now and what we should not be doing now. As an example, I don't think the prophecies concerning Christ's return made as much difference to the brethren during the period of the Antichrist. Why? Because the call doesn't pertain until Christ's second presence. And that's when the call goes out, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins." That's number one. That should be our motive. And that you receive not of her plagues. Perhaps more on that another time. And I think it's also to be cautious of interpretations, either mine or somebody else's, or both mine and somebody else's, if they seem to be unreasonable. Maybe they seem to be unreasonable because they are. But a third point here is, watch for observable evidences that might be able to help us decide whether this interpretation may be correct or that, or whether they may both be incorrect. I will mention my own experiences that I understood from the scriptures 60, 70 years ago that the Soviet Empire, the Eastern Bloc, headed by Russia, Communist Russia, that the Soviet Empire would come to an end. And that in this case, the West would seem to come out on the better end of it. The Soviet Empire would spread more and more till it reached every continent to one degree or another. But I expected from the, that would have been the plague in Egypt, where the east wind brings locusts into all the borders of Egypt until it eats up all the crops, and then the mighty west wind comes and blows them all out again. And from that, oh, the wind that comes and blows them all out again, A powerful wind, that must mean a world war. We'd already seen two. This would be World War III. Well, the Soviet Empire did come to an end, all right, back around 1989. But I was mistaken. It was not World War III. It was local revolutions in each of those countries, even including in Russia itself. So then, as to the next plague after that, it looked to me like if the river Euphrates in Revelation was to be dried up, it would be a deep depression. On the other hand, in the Exodus, it says that the plague was a plague of darkness, thick darkness that could be felt so much that nobody could move from his place for 3 days. And indeed, how did it turn out? During the pandemic or panicdemic, whichever you want to call it, it was in the year 2020, 2021, and 2022 that the travel was restricted. It wasn't a depression that did it. Now that pandemic may be the trigger for a deep depression. And if so, the river Euphrates drying up, Babylon depended upon the river Euphrates for its wealth, its commerce. So the drying up of the Euphrates would be the drying up of the commerce, of the economy that supports Babylon. So I did not predict that it would be a pandemic, but that's the way it turned out. Yes, it has had the effect of being a darkness for 3 days or 3 years. So I've tried twice and been only partly right. And it's good. That way I don't get the idea that I know everything. But we do the best that we can to understand these things. Let's see, how are we doing on time? I think we can go on to one more here. This doesn't come through too well here. Ah, that works better now. What is different about this era in which you and I live? What has been the first truly major worldwide calamity since Noah's flood? Well, there was the Black Plague around 1348, but was it truly worldwide? Did it spread to the Americas? There wasn't a lot of transatlantic trade, let alone trans-Pacific trade, in those days, so we don't have much record that it reached the Americas. Probably not Australia or New Zealand. So it's a little short of being truly worldwide. How about the Reformation? Well, it took a long time before its effects really went around the globe, but it did eventually make it. And the French Revolution? Similarly. Now, there was a better chance that the French Revolution could go worldwide, because now we were starting to have some transoceanic trade. But for something to be truly worldwide took until we had not only the transoceanic trade, but also the transcontinental trade, the trains. And that was developed in the 19th century, the 1800s. So the first truly worldwide event since the flood was the Long Depression. It started in 1873, and then the fall planting of 1874 led to a disastrously poor harvest in the spring of 1875. And as a result, the Ottoman Empire demanded the tithes, the taxes of the Christian farmers in the Balkan Peninsula, and of course they had nothing to pay them with. So what happened? Well, they came and they raided the houses, they took the food, they took the furniture, they took the clothing, anything they could find that they wanted, leaving the Christian farmers with nothing. And that's what led to the Christian Revolt, they call it, of June and July in 1875. And by October of that year, the Ottoman Empire had declared bankruptcy. These were the dominoes that fell one after the other after the other, leading to the Congress of Nations in Berlin that opened up Palestine for anybody who wanted to go and buy and own land there. And the Jews did not miss the opportunity to establish Petah Tikva, November 3rd of 1878. So, it was a small beginning, perhaps, but it was the first major world event since Noah's flood. And that's talking about almost 4,500 years, 4,350 years, something like that. The next major world event, World War I. It brought about the Balfour Declaration. That was to declare Palestine as a homeland for the Jews. And now we go next to the Great Depression. That was in the 1930s. And what is it that we see here? That was when Hitler came to power. And he didn't campaign for election against the Jews. But as soon as he got power, he turned against the Jews. And so initially he allowed the Jews to leave, I think, with up to 50,000 marks to take with them. And 50,000 marks bought a lot more in those days than it does today. And then afterwards, those that didn't leave voluntarily were put in concentration camps, somewhat at the urging of the head of Jerusalem, the Mufti of Jerusalem. And of course, we know that even the, as badly as the Jehovah's Witnesses or JWs were treated in the camps, there was one that was treated even worse than them, and that was the Jews. Now, after that, next major world event, World War II, and now European Jews in general were being persecuted. And so they fled Europe to the extent that they could, but hardly any country in the world was willing to accept them. Even the British were trying to keep them out of Palestine. There is actually one country that did accept them, the Philippines. It was the only one. But it was a stopping point for some until after the war, when Israel became an independent nation. Then they could travel freely to go and settle down in Israel. Next major world after that, after World War II, well, that was the East versus West communist struggle. And there wasn't a place, there's not a country in the world, the Western world, that wasn't seriously affected by communism in one form or another. So now we come to that darkness of 3 days. Is this going to be panic and depression? Will this be what it takes to cause the American Jews also to return home? The American Jews are divided on this. The Orthodox Jews are very much in favor of going over to Israel. They generally prefer to have the youth go over there. They've got the strength to build up the country there. Well, they have the finances. They will finance the youth Jews to go back. and they will simply die out where they are. That is a good thing for Israel, is it not? Well now, if the Jews have gone back from Europe, from North Africa, from Ethiopia, from Asia, and oh yes, especially from Europe and the Americas, there's no more need for them to be coming back from other countries. That leaves only one plague to go, and that would be the plague of Armageddon. See, we're running a little bit slow in time, but I'll just mention one can consider the possibility here that parallel to the worldwide events, we have the plagues of the Exodus. Now, there were 10 plagues in the Exodus. The first three fell upon both the Israelites and the Egyptians. The last 7 plagues fell only upon the Egyptians. The Lord divided between the peoples. That Moses now took the dominant role in administering the plagues. It's not just say unto Aaron, thy brother, do this and that and the other. And the people were separated so that the plagues from this point on fall only upon the Egyptians. Have the plagues of Babylon been a problem for those who put their trust in the Lord? Now, among the 7 last plagues in Egypt, there are 4 of them that are deadly plagues that kill. There was the second plague was disease kills the livestock. That's deadly. The 4th plague, hail and fire, killed the flax and the barley. The next plague, the locusts came and they ate up all of the wheat and the spelt. And of course, the last one, where the firstborn die, that certainly was a deadly plague. Do these logically line up with the disease that killed the livestock in World War I, the 4th, the hail that kills the barley and the flax? Does that line up with World War II? The locusts that come from the east and kill the wheat? Does that sound like a communism coming from the east into all the borders of Egypt, in all the borders of the west? And then, of course, the Armageddon plague has to line up with the death of the firstborn. Well, let's keep watching. Now, if the next thing that happens is a World War III without any depression, then, okay, I have misunderstood something here. Or was the depression something that happened as a result of the COVID? I'll let others decide that. I'll just simply keep watching and waiting. But it does also imply that we're getting closer to the completion of the church. And we don't look forward to Armageddon, but we certainly look forward to what happens afterwards.